I'm going to begin this lesson with a most unusual statement. It's a statement that a lot of people have a lot of trouble with. And I can understand why. Because as with so many of the messages from the Conversations with God dialogues, this message runs counter to, that is, it contradicts virtually everything we've been taught by everyone in our lives, by our parents, by our schools, by our churches and synagogues and temples and religions, if we belong to them, by our political parties, by our elders, by just about everybody, by our culture and our society. Every one of the messages of great importance from Conversations with God seems to contradict what we have been told in our lives. That's what makes the Conversations with God material not only spiritually, but socially revolutionary. If the messages of Conversations with God, especially its most important and prominent messages, were actually embraced and applied to daily life, we would find that we would have turned everything really upside down. And that certainly would be true if we embraced the message that is the topic, the message that is the subject of this particular lesson. The message of this lesson is quite simple, but it's very dramatic. There is no such thing as right and wrong. What? People would say. And they've said to me at lectures and workshops and presentations that I've made around the world, what? How can that be true? There's no such thing as right and wrong? There's no moral construction of any kind? There are no delineations or differentiations between right and wrong of any kind? How can that be true? And so, in order to explain it and to explain what Conversations with God means with regard to this lesson, I have to explain a little bit more about God itself, about the kingdom of God, if we could call it that, about ultimate reality, perhaps is a better phrase, itself. In ultimate reality, in what some people call the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God, there are no delineations or differentiations between right and wrong. That is, the concepts of right and wrong don't exist in the mind of God. That itself, of course, is blasphemy, according to most of the world's religions. So we would have to embrace an idea of God itself that is totally foreign to most people, because it is, as I said, totally contradictory, totally the opposite of what our religions teach us. How can it be possible for there to be no such thing as right and wrong in the mind of God? I want you to think about it in a brand new way. I want you to understand who and what God is. If, in fact, God is the all in all, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the sum total of everything, then God would have to be embracing everything. That is, nothing could exist that God does not have. Nothing could exist that God would want, because God has and is everything. And if God is really the all-powerful, the most powerful essence, if you please, or if some people want to personify it, the most powerful being in the universe, what could damage God? What could hurt God? What could injure God? And if nothing can, the answer, of course, is nothing. And if nothing can damage, injure, or hurt God, then what would cause God to be angry? What could cause God to say, this is right and that's wrong? If nothing, in a sense, mattered to God with regard to what we were doing. Now, you might say, Neil, you know, that's a crazy hypothesis. Of course things matter to God in terms of what we're doing. But I want to tell you that, in fact, even you as a human being, have managed to find yourself in a place where you could love so unconditionally that nothing that the person you loved could do would matter to you. You would neither call it right nor wrong. You would have no judgment about it whatsoever. Do you think that's possible? Have you ever loved anyone at that level that no matter what they did, you would not call it right or wrong? Well, let's use the example of a mom with her baby. I'm going to use a striking example to make a point. Supposing a mother has, or a father, a mommy or a daddy, has a 1-week-old or a 1-month-old or even a 1-year-old baby. Can the baby really do anything that's right or wrong? Can the 2-year-old child really do anything that's so right or so wrong that you would punish it with everlasting condemnation? Or would you find yourself in a position where no matter what that child did, even things that were not right in your mind, even things that you thought, you know, that you wish they hadn't done, even those kinds of things, we sometimes smile. We sometimes smile as a small child, you know, commits a so-called social sin or whatever they do. And we smile at it. Why? Why can we smile at it? How can we embrace it? How can we even move past forgiveness? I was going to say, how can we forgive it? But we don't even use forgiveness. We move past forgiveness. Forgiveness is not even necessary because understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. Remember that, by the way. Write that one down someplace. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. So how can we even move past forgiveness and smile and find even joy in the so-called mistakes or errors of a baby? Because, number one, we understand how they could make such a mistake. And number two, we know that their mistakes can't damage or hurt us in any way. It's a baby. There's nothing they could do that could really anger us or disappoint us or upset us or hurt us or damage us or injure us in any kind of serious way. We understand that. So the point is that the child is harmless and cannot harm us. We are unable to be harmed by a little baby. And so we would not consider that a baby does something right or wrong. They just do what they do. They're little, and we smile at it even. Now, if you can understand that, if you can understand how it's possible for us to even find joy because we love the baby so much that we would never condemn the baby or not forgive the baby. We would simply smile and love the baby even more. If you can understand that, then you can understand God's relationship to us. Because please understand that in the mind of God, we are like babies. Compared to all that God knows, even though we claim we know a great deal, even though we think that we are an evolved species, compared to all the wisdom in the universe and all that God understands about ultimate reality, we know what a baby knows compared to us as adult human beings. We are really the babies of the universe. I'm not sure whether you're aware of this, but human beings, the human species, is a very, very young species. Let me give you an example of just how young we are. If someone once wrote in a book, I'm sorry I can't give you the title of the book right now, but I remember the passage in a particular book I read. And in that book it said, if you took the age of the earth and put it on a calendar year, if you overlaid the age of the earth on a calendar year, where the beginning of time would be January 1st, and this day would be December 31st. If you did that, if you chose to do that, for purposes of scale, you would discover that the first form of life, single cell, primitive life forms, did not appear on this planet until the end of February or the beginning of March. More sophisticated life forms did not appear on the Earth, fishes in the sea, birds in the air, until somewhere toward the end of November. Dinosaurs did not appear until December the 5th. Dinosaurs did not disappear on that scale until December the 25th. Humanoids, not even human beings, but beings that walked on two legs, something like human beings, did not appear until December 31st. Human beings did not appear until the last hour of December 31st. And all that has happened in recorded history has taken place in the last 60 seconds of the year, in the last minute of the year. That's how young we are as a species compared to the age of our planet. Forget about the age of the cosmos. Now, imagine how a God, the Supreme Being, the ultimate essence, the essential energy of the universe, would relate to us being as young as we are, just a fraction of a minute old compared to the age of the Earth, not even the age of the cosmos. How would God relate to us? Would God be less charitable with us than we are with a two-week-old baby or a two-year-old child? I don't think so. And so I hope I've been able to create a context within which you can understand the extraordinary statement from Conversations with God. There is no such thing as right and wrong. But, of course, we've been told that there are rights and wrongs. There are those things. I'm going to read you a list here because I want to get this accurately so that we can really understand what we've been taught prior to this present day. For Jews and many Christians, there has been a prominent public pronouncement of what is right and wrong, and that's called the Ten Commandments. For Muslims, it is the Five Pillars of Islam. For Buddhists, the Noble Eightfold Path and the Five Precepts. For Hindus, the doctrine of the fourfold end of life. For members of the Baha'i faith, they follow the Katib-e-Aqdas, the Book of Laws of Baha'u'llah. And virtually every religion on the face of the earth has its understanding, its set of rules, its set of laws about what is right and what is wrong. And I want to use the same analogy I just used a minute ago. It would be like us handing a piece of paper to a one-year-old baby, even if the baby could read, and say, here are the rules of babyhood. Here are the things you have to do. And here are the rules and regulations of being a human being. And I want you to get this right. I know you're only, 16 weeks old or 18 months old or a year old, but you need to get this right because this is what's right and this is what's wrong. And I expect you to understand and I expect you to obey the rules. We wouldn't do that, obviously, to a one-year-old baby or any child. Nor would God do it to us. So the problem with our present standard of right and wrong is that it's doing more harm than good because it's based on a false precept, a false concept of what is true in ultimate reality. The concepts of right and wrong are based on the condition or the experience of benefit or damage. You understand? See, right and wrong, the whole concept that something is right and something is wrong is based on the idea of benefit or damage. If a thing benefits us or benefits society in general, we call it right. If a thing damages us or damages society in general, we call it wrong. But now we've already established in this lesson that God can neither be hurt, injured, or damaged. God can also not be benefited. You can't benefit God. Can you imagine trying to do something that would benefit God? It would be like giving a penny to a billionaire. I mean, he might say thank you for the penny, but he wouldn't feel necessarily particularly benefited. Oh my goodness, I'm so glad I got this penny, because I only have $1 billion in the bank and this penny is going to make a difference. So I'm using these illustrations to help your mind understand how impossible it would be for us to damage or benefit God. And since the notions of benefit or damage do not exist in the mind of God, are not part of the kingdom of heaven, the whole basis of what we call right and wrong evaporates and disappears. But on the earth, we do experience benefit and damage. And see, we imagine that God is like human beings. They say that human beings were made in the image of likeness of God, but in fact we've created God in the image and likeness of human beings. And we think that God is just like us. So because we imagine we can be benefit or damaged, we imagine God can be benefit or damaged as well. So we've made up ideas about what's good and evil, what's right and wrong, based on our experience of being benefited or of being damaged, both of which are made up. We're making it all up, ladies and gentlemen. We're making things up as we go along. I'm an older person now, and I've been around the world several times, and I can tell you that I've encountered cultures in which the notion of right and wrong has been turned upside down in my life. Let me give you a good example. I went to the Netherlands for the first time, around maybe 10 or 15, perhaps at this point about 20 years ago. I was in the Netherlands in a city called Amsterdam. I'm sure you've heard of Amsterdam. Folks, there's a red light district in Amsterdam. It's an entire long street. It's not just a little house or a little building. It's an entire street. Storefronts in which women of the night, ladies of the evening, advertise what they have to offer in windows, like shop windows. They actually sit in the windows and display what they could offer you if you choose to pay for it. Not only is this totally acceptable in Amsterdam, it's actually a source of considerable tax income for the city. It's actually a source of revenue because prostitution is legal in Amsterdam. The first time I went there, even though I'm pretty open-minded and fairly liberal as a person, even I was just a little bit scandalized. I thought, wow, I understand that prostitution is legal here, but they're that open about it? They're that open? They don't even try to hide it? They don't even try to be discreet? There's no discretion. It's just right out there in a shop window. So my sensibilities were kind of like shocked a little bit. I have to admit it. And I was, 50 years old, and I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never seen any kind of openness like that. So, but I learned to live. By the way, not only is prostitution legal in Amsterdam, just about everything else is too. Amsterdam is a place where just about everything is legal. Drugs, you can buy any kind of drug you want. I mean, marijuana, whatever it is. If you want to do something, if you want to really get away with it and live a libertine life, just move to Amsterdam. I'm sure my friends in Amsterdam are not going to be happy about my saying that. Or maybe they'll chuckle about it, but that's just what's true. Do you know that in the age when my grandparents were young, living together was considered to be a sin? In 1917, living together out of wedlock without being married was considered a scandal. It was scandalous. It was even scandalous for my mother to marry my father because my mother and father were both divorced. And this was in the late 30s and the early 40s. When my mother and father got together, they had both divorced and they chose to marry each other, and the family was scandalized. Well, first they were scandalized that they got divorced. Then they were really scandalized when they decided to get married, to marry each other. You weren't supposed to marry a divorced person, especially if you were Catholic. If God were making up the rules of what is right and wrong, the rules wouldn't change and be different based on the map or the calendar. See, I mean, prostitution would be wrong in Amsterdam, just like it's wrong in Peoria, Illinois. Living together out of wedlock without being married would be wrong in 2018, just as it would be wrong in 1918. You see, it wouldn't be a matter of location or time if right and wrong were absolutes. But obviously, they're not absolutes. So we get clear that human beings are making it all up. We're deciding what's right and wrong based on context, based on the context within which we place the choice. Are you understanding what I'm saying? For instance, is driving 175 miles an hour right or wrong? Well, of course, it depends where you are. It depends on the context. It's totally okay if you're trying to win the Indianapolis 500 Speedway race. In fact, you're probably going too slow. So it's totally okay to drive 175 miles an hour at the Indianapolis 500. But if you're trying to get to the local grocery store without killing yourself or hurting anybody else and without getting a ticket that will cost you a great deal of money and might even put you in jail, probably driving 175 miles an hour is not a good idea. So we get that you can drive 175 miles an hour on a racetrack, but probably shouldn't drive 175 miles an hour driving through town. Again, I use a simple, if not a silly example, to make a point. We have decided, and it's quite appropriate for us to decide, that right or wrong are based on the context. That is, what are you doing, when are you doing it, and where are you doing it? The only problem in human experiences is that while we have quite appropriately decided that context should create our definition of what is okay and not okay, of what is right and what is wrong, we have found ourselves in an extraordinary situation where we don't relate the context to results. In other words, it doesn't seem to matter to us whether the decision we've made has produced results that benefit us. So we say sometimes that things are wrong or things are right, even though the results that those decisions make are not benefiting us and have actually damaged us and hurt us. Let me give you a striking example of that, to give you one more example from human experience. Gay marriage. In the United States, for a long, long, long time, gay marriage was considered wrong. It's still considered wrong in some places according to some people's understanding of the laws of God. But actually, gay marriage was considered wrong according to the laws of the state. That is, the government laws said you couldn't marry a person of the same sex because it was considered wrong. And it didn't matter what results were produced by that decision. Results didn't seem to matter. Even if it created thousands, billions, millions of unhappy people around the world, it didn't matter. Even if it created ultimately revolt and anger on the part of many people, it didn't matter. So our decisions about right and wrong have not even been connected with the results that those decisions have produced. It simply doesn't matter. We have to make a fundamental decision as human beings. And that decision is, will right and wrong be based on morals? That is, our understanding of what God wants, our understanding of what is morally correct, or will right and wrong be based on function? That is, what produces functionality, that is, what works in the human experience. Now we get to a point that I made in one of my earlier lessons, in lesson number 3, that talked about there's nothing you have to do. We talk again about that same lesson. If there's nothing you have to do, if there are no requirements, then we have to find a new standard, a new moral code, a new reason for doing or not doing a thing. And that applies here as well. Humanity must make a final decision. One, what is it we're trying to do? What are we actually trying to do on this planet? What is our purpose? Do we intend to create peace? Do we intend to produce prosperity? Do we intend to guarantee our safety and the safety of others, those we love? Are we intending to generate the kind of life that can offer the basic dignities to all? What are we trying to do here? What are we trying to do on the earth? What is our purpose and function with regard to our spiritual life? Should our spiritual life even have anything to do with our physical life on earth? And what should the relationship be between the two? These are the questions that human beings have not really taken as close a look at as you'd like to think. We've simply accepted what other people have told us. We've accepted what we've been told by our parents, by our families, by our culture, by our society, by the global state of things, and for that matter, by our religions. We've allowed other people to tell us what's right and wrong, even though in our own hearts we have sometimes felt that those instructions were not benefiting us and not really benefiting anybody. So now I invite you to take a look at what your life would be like if you decided that there is really no such thing as absolute right and absolute wrong, but that right and wrong were contextual, depending on what you're doing, when you're doing it, why you're doing it, and the results that doing it most often has produced in the past. That would create a whole new construction, a whole new model of the world. Conversations with God told us quite famously, nobody does anything inappropriate given their model of the world. Did you hear that? Conversations with God tells us, nobody does anything inappropriate given their model of the world. If we don't like what people are doing, if we don't like the results that we are generating on the planet, if we don't like the outcomes that have been produced by our collective decisions about what is right and wrong, we may want to take a close look at the model of the world that we have created. A model of the world that includes righteousness, punishment, and an angry, vindictive God? Or might it be a model of the world that emanates and arises from simple unconditional love, from our understanding that freedom is the basis of love, and that freedom is the highest value of all of life everywhere, because it is the highest demonstration of divinity. If the purpose of life is to demonstrate divinity, a point I've made in previous lessons, if that is the purpose of life, then we ask, how can we best demonstrate divinity? How can we most effectively demonstrate divinity? And the answer is freedom. The words freedom and God are virtually interchangeable. God, of course, is the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the all-loving, the all-everything. And so God is free to do whatever God chooses to do without any worry about what's going to happen to God if God makes this choice or that choice. Total freedom to create whatever we wish to create. The central question among human beings, as young as we are, would be this. Could we exist as a civilization if we were totally free to make our own decisions about what works and does not work for us within a particular context? That's the central question facing humanity. We have been saying for centuries, for millennia, that the answer is no. We can't live as totally free human beings. We don't have that level of responsibility. We don't have that level of understanding. And you know what? I think to some degree, at some level, that may be accurate. That is, humanity has understood that it's very young and very immature. But now I think we are moving to a place where things are changing. Now I think it's become clear to us that humanity itself as a species is growing and evolving to the point where we really do understand the consequences of our actions, the reasons for the choices we are making, and the whole reason for life itself, the divine spiritual reason, as well as the simplistic human reasons that we apply to our life on Earth. As we mature as a species, might it now be time to shift our understanding about this whole notion of right or wrong? I think it's true that this is the time to do that. I think the answer to the question is yes. It's right to do that. Unless it's wrong, we get to decide based on the results. Brand new definitions can start in your own life. You don't have to wait for all of society, for your political party, for your religion, for your culture to change its ideas for the collective known as humanity. What would happen if you just changed your ideas individually? How would that change your single life? And how would the life that you are living become an example for others so that soon everyone would begin to see, there is a new way to be human, a more powerful, a more effective, a more loving, a more caring, a more divine way to be human. And the first level of that understanding, the first level of that behavior would be to eliminate our thoughts that someone else gets to decide for us what's right or wrong. To eliminate the idea that even right or wrong as definitions exist. To forget about even using the words right or wrong. To start using the words, it works or it does not work, given who I am and what I'm trying to do. And if what I'm trying to do is live a life of divine wisdom, divine clarity, and divine love, suddenly what's working or not working for me will become obvious in the moment of the choices I have to make. That's my thought about it. I could, of course, be wrong about all of that. But I don't think so.